This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. American policymakers are never quite sure what to do about the government of Iran. The Bush administration condemns Iran's nuclear program and its support for insurgents in Iraq, Afghanistan, Lebanon, and Gaza. But many argue that engagement with Iran is critical to progress in Iraq and easing tensions in the Middle East generally. Our guest, BBC correspondent Frances Harrison, has spent much of the past 3 years taking her listeners inside the country President Bush once labeled part of the Axis of Evil. Harrison chronicled the political and cultural changes in Iran since the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad brought an end to what Westerners regard as a period of reform in the country. Before going to Tehran in 2004, Frances Harrison reported for the BBC from Pakistan, Kuala Lumpur, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. Well, Frances Harrison, welcome to Fresh Air. You've spent time in Tehran, kind of spanning the reform period, which generally is thought to have lasted from, I guess, 97 until 2005, and then have been there since then as the climate has changed. And, you know, one measure of the degree of political openness of a society is how journalists can operate. How are you finding things? Are Iranians less likely to talk to a foreign journalist these days?
The atmosphere is closed in a major way, I would say, in the last year or so. We've had 2 years of President Ahmadinejad, an ultra-conservative, an extreme hardliner in power. Things didn't change socially immediately. It took a while before he made his mark. But certainly in the last few months, there's been a serious crackdown both on journalists, on political opponents and activists, on some civil servants and on social freedom. So many students I know have been jailed. And human rights organizations say they've been beaten in jail, including one that I knew very well who was a good source for us. 2 or 3 days after I left the country, he was arrested and he's in solitary confinement. And I had repeatedly warned him not to come to our office and to be careful because of the risk of arrest. But there are people in Iran, students and other activists, who are extremely brave and who feel that they have to speak out about what's happening there.
Now, do you suffer direct interference for the government? I mean, are you followed? Are your reports censored?
I don't think that I'm followed. I wasn't aware of being followed. But I know that all the staff and, you know, support staff are questioned by the Ministry of Intelligence, not necessarily, you know, every week or every month, but periodically questioned in order to make sure that they're a source of information. And I assume that my telephones were all tapped, including my mobile. And I believe that they were, but not necessarily everything was listened to all the time. And, you know, they basically, you had to have written permission from the Ministry of Islamic Guidance, which is like the information ministry, in order to travel for work outside Tehran. And you had to apply for it 72 hours in advance. And quite often they would say no. So in practice, in the last year or two, it's been impossible to go to any of the border areas bordering Iraq or Afghanistan. And even towns, some towns like Natanz, where the nuclear site is, I did get to go once, but, you know, sometimes you're not allowed to go. So any kind of travel outside Tehran requires written permission. A lot of filming inside Tehran or recording or interviews requires, again, written permission from the government. And quite often, if it's something that's sensitive, they just say no, or they don't say anything at all. They just don't answer.
But once you actually write your reports, you're able to file them without interference?
Yes, you're able to file them, but the question is what happens to your permission to operate thereafter, whether there are any complaints, what happens to your visa if you're a foreigner. We've seen quite a few British journalists having their visas not renewed. The journalist for the Independent newspaper, I know the Guardian correspondent had some problems. So, you know, there can be repercussions and everyone is aware of that.
Well, does any of this, including the threat of having your visa taken away, caused you to censor yourself, do you think, to moderate what you would otherwise report?
I think you're very careful about how you say things. But in my case, no, I think I was quite outspoken about some of the things that started to happen in the last 6 months. I don't know whether if I'd remained in Iran, I would have been able to continue to do that. It's very difficult. But I don't have a visa. I'm a dual national because I'm married to an Iranian. I have an Iranian passport. But, you know, then a lot of, you know, lawyers and human rights activists and other journalists joke with you that it's not a question of being kicked out. It's a question of not being allowed to leave. You know, the government could stop me leaving the country, which is more alarming.
Now, you wrote in April about the crackdown over dress codes for women. Give us a sense of how standards changed during the reform period and what's happened since.
Well, during the reform period, it became a lot more liberal in terms of dress. So, for example, colours were allowed. Now, that may sound like a very minor point to be able to wear a pink headscarf or a red one as opposed to black or brown or blue. I mean, originally the colours were very sober. But, you know, for people who want to express themselves, express their personality and look attractive, it's actually very important. It sounds very trivial, but it's not. And then the tightness of the overcoat you wear. Basically, Iranian women by law have to cover their hair. And it got the boundaries of what was acceptable got pushed back so that people were wearing these sort of glittery, diaphanous scarves. They were pushed back on the back of their heads. They started to wear a lot more makeup, you know, nail polish, tight trousers, very tight overcoats. They have to wear an overcoat that covers their main part of their body, supposedly down to their knees. But, you know, during the summer, some of the young, sort of trendy North Tehran elite would be wearing overcoats that were sort of mid-thigh and very, very tight, you know, a sort of size too small. And, you know, they look gorgeous. They look very attractive. Despite being covered Islamically, they looked very chic and very fashionable. And obviously that was allowed to happen for some time. It gradually went on and on. Things became probably, I think, the most liberal they'd ever been since the revolution. You'd see boys and girls walking down the street holding hands, people wearing these, you know, very fashionable clothes. And then from April, the beginning of the Persian New Year, the government decided to crack down on that and to try and stop that. Periodically, every summer, the beginning of every summer, there is a crackdown because summer, of course, being much, much hotter, people wear more outrageous clothes and thinner clothes and so on. So there's a kind of nominal crackdown just to try and keep things in check. But this year, it was much, much more ferocious.
So what's the new standard? What are they insisting upon now?
Well, they want people to wear coats down to their knee, not too tight, to wear socks on their shoes, not on their feet, not to wear sandals. I know a Sri Lankan lady who was arrested because she was on a bus wearing sandals, not wearing socks and shoes. So they want people to cover their feet. They want the headscarf to be right at the front of the forehead so that no hair shows, and much less makeup than before.
And what do you wear when you go out in public?
Well, when I'm on camera or out in public in Tehran, like anybody else, I have to wear an overcoat and a headscarf. And if I'm going to a government office, I would have to wear socks and shoes, which in 45-degree heat is awful. I mean, I think that's one of the worst things. It's not so bad wearing it in winter because, you know, it's snowing and it's, you know, it's okay to wear a coat. It's just that you normally actually in winter have to wear two. You have to wear an overcoat, the sort of woolen, you know, normal one you wear outdoors, and then you have to wear another one indoors because everything's so heavily heated. So when you get inside, you can't, you know, sit in your overcoat. It's too hot. So you have to have another kind of cotton one inside. But yeah, I go around looking like anybody else in Iran, wearing the same sort of clothes. I do wear more colourful headscarves because I'm on TV quite a lot when I'm there. So, you know, you can't go around dressed completely in black. Nobody can see you. So I wear more colourful ones. But most journalists, women journalists, Iranian ones, have kind of tended since the presidential elections when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad came to power, they sort of immediately opted for black again because they just didn't want to have any problems over their dress.
And how is the dress code enforced? I mean, do police literally stop women on the street?
Since April, when there's been this crackdown, yes, there have been women police and male police on the streets rounding people up. They've had buses, they've filled the buses with women they consider improperly dressed, and they've been taking them to the police station, often keeping young girls for many hours late at night in the police station without their families, and then sending them to the courts.
And you wrote a piece about the police department staging a fashion show at which the proper Islamic garb was featured. Is that right?
Yes, that was the, I think, one and only sort of public fashion show in Iran. There are these clandestine fashion shows held in the sort of basement of people's apartment blocks, which show off, you know, the latest concoctions of various designers, but those are totally illegal and not approved by the government. But this was something that the government had authorized and allowed to happen, and now they're saying that they won't have any more fashion shows like that. They've kind of thought better of it. But the idea was to try and give women more choice about what they can wear while still remaining, you know, reasonably individualistic and fashionable and yet still more Islamic than what you see on the street. The bizarre thing was that they allowed the male journalists and photographers to stay for the first 5-10 minutes, and then they said that all of them, all the cameras and male journalists, had to leave for the second half of it, and we obviously got to stay being women. And although all the clothes in the second half were actually kind of office clothes that you could wear to work, and people were fully covered, so we weren't quite sure why only women were allowed to see those. But they had a catwalk with, you know, the sort of smoke that billows out, very loud sort of LA Persian pop music playing, and these women in high heels and lots of makeup parading up and down the catwalk wearing chador. I don't know if you know what chador is. It's this huge black kind of enveloping cape that women, Shiite women wear, some of them. And they had these, but with sort of pearl edging and diamante and so on, and in different colours, some of them with sleeves. I mean, the most Islamic clothing you can imagine, but with high-heeled shoes, makeup and catwalk sort of environment. It was extremely odd.
And were you impressed with the fashions? I mean, was there enough diversity so that it looked like something different, something that you might find attractive?
Well, there were only of the things they showed afterwards in private to women, there were one or two that weren't bad. They were promoting wearing long skirts, which is something that you couldn't do now at all. You really have to wear trousers. And that was quite nice to see what they'd kind of come up with in terms of long shirts and long skirts. So there were one or two that I would consider wearing. The rest were a little bit frumpy, I think. And certainly the women in the audience who were kind of quite... A lot of them were quite critical, many of them young fashion designers from the universities who'd come to look at it. And they were saying, well, look, you know, look at what people wear on the streets. On the streets, people really do look like fashion models. And these models are not so pretty, they're not so attractive, and the clothes are a bit kind of frumpy. So certainly true that when you see some Iranian women on the streets, maybe not so much now, there's a crackdown, but before, they are dressed up to the nines. I mean, they are extremely, you know, they take a lot of time and care about their appearance.
But they
in fact, the authorities call them Western dolls.
And how do the Islamic clerical, the more conservative clerical leaders feel about a fashion show where women are prancing around in makeup with, you know, smoke blowing around them and rock music?
Well, they clearly don't like it. That's why they've stopped having any more in future. I mean, these are the same sort of clerics who don't think that women should be allowed to watch football matches, for example. One point, President Ahmadinejad tried to say that women should be allowed in to see these matches, football being the most sort of, you know, popular sport in Iran and a huge kind of national interest, and women being really into it now. And several grand ayatollahs in Qom simply said, no, it's not acceptable. You cannot have women in football stadiums because they're looking at men who are wearing shorts, and it's not proper.
Last year, the government of Iran hosted a conference questioning the Holocaust. And you wrote in one piece that it kind of evoked the dilemma that someone might have faced in Nazi Germany on how to report on Hitler, whether you take sides. How did you report on this event?
Well, I have to say, it was quite extraordinary. I think if somebody had told me the day before that I would meet somebody like David Duke, who's an ex-Ku Klux Klan member in Tehran, I wouldn't have believed them. I would have thought they were pulling my leg, but he was there. And the Iranian embassy in London, we heard, actually opened on a Sunday night in order to issue visas to many of the guests. And the guest list was like a sort of roll call of so-called revisionists, Holocaust deniers and questioners from around the world, from all different countries, from Europe, from Canada, from Australia, from all sorts of places who turned up there. And the more you sort of dug into the past and the history and who was who there amongst the guest list, it was quite shocking. And I think it was such a sort of blatant move that it troubled a lot of expats working in Iran, people, for example, like aid workers working in the UN and so on, who felt that their presence was beneficial, felt that they were trying to help the Iranian people, and on balance, despite the human rights record of the government, it was still worthwhile being there and trying to do something and trying to engage with the government and trying not to isolate it. I think they were very troubled by this whole conference. It made them question really what on earth they were doing engaging with the Iranian government.
And do you think the Iranian government knew what kind of people they would be associating with in doing this?
I think they must have known. I mean, it's not right. difficult to right. find out the information about these people. You just have to kind of Google them and you find out who they are on the internet. They had everyone who was anyone amongst these sort of people. And yes, I think it was quite difficult to do balanced reporting in a sense because, you know, these people were expressing opinions that were really in a way too odious or too appalling to give airtime to. And so our kind of approach was to report on the phenomenon of the conference and who was there, but not to give airtime to some of their sort of views about how nobody died in a gas chamber and so on, or the numbers who died were so small and what have you, and their various theories about it and their sort of models of Treblinka and these sort of things that they brought with them. We didn't give airtime to that. But it was quite difficult to kind of keep them at arm's length because they kept wanting to tell you these things. And when they realized how we'd broadcast about their presence at the conference, they became quite hostile. I received a lot of very offensive emails from the people who'd been at the conference. I mean, very offensive indeed after that.
And what was your sense of how citizens of Tehran felt about this issue of the Holocaust?
Well, I think it's a bit sad for Iran and Iranians that they got so sort of branded by this conference, because what we found was ordinary young Iranians, I mean, we're talking about university students and a bit older, simply had no idea what the Holocaust was. They're just not taught about it at school. They don't see it on TV. It's something that's very far away. It's a sort of European thing. It's not part of Middle Eastern history as far as they see it. And they just, you'd go up to them in the street and you'd say, what do you think about the Holocaust? What do you know about the Holocaust? And they wouldn't know what it was at all. And the older generation we spoke to, some of them did know more about the history of Europe and the Second World War. They were, some of them, quite critical. They'd found a way of being quite subtle in saying that this wasn't really of any relevance to them. And they would say, look, you know, we need more jobs and we need better living conditions and so on. Why do we have to interfere, get involved in these sort of things that aren't really part of our history? And the sad thing, too, is that actually during the Second World War, the Iranian government at the time played quite a role in getting Jewish children out of Eastern Europe. They're known as the Tehran children, and they went on to Israel afterwards. But a large number of Jewish children from Poland were helped by the Iranian embassy there to escape through Iran. So unfortunately, you know, Iran has this history of having played a positive role. And yet now, of course, its image internationally is completely, you know, tarred by this one conference.
Well, you know, there is a Jewish population in Iran, about 25,000, which, you know, not large, certainly large by Middle Eastern standards outside.
The largest, actually, in Middle East. Yeah.
Right. Outside of Israel. Mm. Give us a sense of sort of what kind of religious and ethnic tolerance there is of their presence.
I think amongst ordinary Iranians, there's quite a bit of tolerance and respect for other religions, for Christians. There are a lot of Armenian Christians as well in Iran, and they're given quite a bit of status. I mean, people are quite respectful of them. There's no sense of segregation. And the same, Islam recognizes Judaism and Christianity as religions of the book. So they're officially recognized after the revolution by Ayatollah Khomeini as religions of the book, as officially sanctioned religions inside Iran. So there is a Jewish MP and there is a Christian MP and so on. So they're given a lot more freedom than other religions. I think in a way Zoroastrians complain, who are the original Persian religion, they complain that they have less status in Iran because they're not religions of the book, as it were. And certainly kind of Baha'is, who are a form of what the Iranian government would see as a deviant sect of Islam, they are persecuted quite seriously in Iran. So Jews and Christians have a certain degree of space within which to operate that's not too bad. I mean, they say that their main problem is the fact that there's so few of them, that it's really hard to find someone for their children to marry, or, you know, that they're lonely socially, that they don't go to weddings because everybody's emigrated and gone to America or to Israel. So there are a lot of problems for the community, and most of them don't work in government service of any kind, because then they would face prejudice. I think they work in sort of, they're the kind of middle class who work in private businesses, small companies, and they have something to stay for in Iran, and they're not willing to give it all up and go abroad necessarily. But it goes through waves. I mean, there have been times when Jews have been arrested and accused of spying for Israel, and it's sent shockwaves throughout the community. The recent remarks in the Holocaust conference and so on have alarmed Jews in Iran.
If you have a president who is embracing Holocaust deniers, I mean, is that a signal that this government will be blatantly anti-Semitic and will stir, you know, anti-Semitic actions?
Well, of course, he says that he's anti-Zionist, not anti-Semitic. But having this conference, of course, was something that Jews in Iran, as elsewhere, felt was deeply offensive. And in fact, the Jewish MP did come out on the eve of the conference and say that he felt it was offensive and that it would upset the Jewish population in Iran, and that it might well trigger a new wave of emigration abroad amongst Iranian Jews. So, yes, they are worried about these comments about wiping Israel off the map and the Holocaust not having happened to the extent that it did happen and so on. That does alarm Jews in Iran. And there have been some very right-wing Islamic papers inside Iran who have tried to say that Iranian Jews have been celebrating Israel's Independence Day and this sort of thing. And then with actually bogus pictures that show synagogues inside Israel, not inside Iran, but they say in the caption that the pictures are inside Iran. So there have been people who've been trying to stir trouble in that way. But I think on the whole, the Jews that remain in Iran feel very determinedly Persian or Iranian. They feel that their culture is Persian, that they want to remain in the country if they possibly can. You know, they have this huge sense of history that they've been in Iran, you know, since before the Bible, since 3,000 years ago, that they were protected by Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire, that they speak Farsi, that they don't speak Hebrew really properly, they eat Persian food, you know, they feel that they read Persian poetry, they feel very Iranian and they don't want to be forced out. So many of them feel that they will stay here until they cannot stay in Iran.
One of the things you've written about is the peculiar attitude that Iranians have towards the British. Tell us about that and about being a British reporter in Iran.
Well, I think it's probably the worst nationality to be in Iran, certainly worse than being American. I mean, when I see my colleagues from the US who, you know, get visas and come for short trips to Iran, you know, they're treated like royalty in a way. I mean, there's this sort of glamour of the unknown and, you know, schoolgirls will come up to them at demonstrations and ask for their autographs and, you know, they get interviews with officials and all this sort of thing because of being kind of exotic, if you like. Whereas, you know, Britain has an embassy in Tehran, so if anybody wants to attack the West, they go and throw stones at the British embassy. There is no American embassy anymore, obviously. And we have BBC has an office there. So, you know, when they want to attack the Western media, it tends to be the BBC. The Iranians have this kind of long historical problem with Britain because of Britain's role in the nationalization, trying to stop the nationalization of the oil industry, Britain's historic role as a colonial power, its occupation of Iran, parts of Iran during the Second World War, a whole range of kind of historical grievances that it has. And there is this popular idea, and people say it as a sort of half joke but half serious, where they say, well, there's a British hand behind everything. They say, that's the English push to hammer cheese house in Farsi. It means the British hand is behind everything. And when you say that as a British person to, you know, a taxi driver or some official or whatever, they laugh, but they laugh rather nervously, as if you sort of discovered their guilty secret. And it's half joke, half serious. I mean, there is this thing that they feel that Brits are very kind of devious and clever and behind everything. So, you know, there are jokes like if you remove the turban of a mullah, it will say made in Britain on it. And there are many Iranians who say, oh, somehow it's the British that created the Islamic Revolution.
Now, as a journalist, you because you deal in controversial topics, often find yourself at the center of controversy. What kind of reactions have you gotten from all sides of the Iranian political spectrum and probably, you know, foreign powers as well? It's an age when people can, you know, can blog and can email and let you know how they think.
Well, both sides I've had it from at times. Quite vicious attacks from abroad. For example, blogs abroad who are kind of pro-Zionist or right-wing who say that, you know, I am supporting the Islamic regime. I've had things like, for example, one of them put a photograph of a woman wearing a kind of magniyeh, it's a black sort of Islamic kind of hood thing, headscarf, and she had a noose around her head next to an article about me, and they knew perfectly well I was a woman because they'd written lots of things about how shocking it was that I had an Iranian husband. And the, you know, the implication was that this woman, Frances Harrison, should be hanged. And I've had blogs that have asked, you know, whether my husband beats me because he's a Muslim, which is outrageous. Or said that my husband is a pro-government journalist in Iran, which is also outrageous because he actually wasn't allowed to work for more than a year in Iran and he's never worked for the Iranian media. So, you know, some pretty vicious personal stuff. I've also had a lot of attacks, or not attacks or discussion or kind of interest because of having to wear a headscarf on air. You know, basically, if I'm outdoors in Iran, I have to wear the headscarf. In the TV studio, I wear it because I'm in an office with men. Legally, I have to wear it in Iran. And, you know, I'm often standing in front of a picture which sort of pretends that I'm outdoors. And I've had people emailing the BBC, people ringing up the BBC complaining about why is your correspondent wearing a headscarf? You know, it means that she's not objective and so on and so forth. And then, you know, at one point there were like 40 emails to the BBC, to one blog, discussing my red headscarf and, you know, whether I wore it out of conviction or not, how much makeup I was wearing at the same time and all this. And it was most bizarre. But, you know, it can be quite sort of disturbing to be the centre of quite so much attention. I mean, gets to the point where people question your independence, your integrity. It's almost like sort of pointing the finger and saying, oh, you're a traitor.
You know, we talked a good bit about what's happening with the situation of women's rights and dress codes and other issues that affect women in Iran. One of the fascinating developments there that you've written about is that more women than men are now getting higher education, which is probably not what a lot of people would think of a society that they would regard as repressive towards women. What are the implications?
Well, I think this is a major misconception. And in fact, this is another story where I got quite badly attacked on internet sites abroad by right-wingers who said that the women I'd seen in universities were all daughters of the regime and this was nonsense and women were oppressed in Iran and so on. I think, you know, obviously the argument that women are oppressed is used as an argument for regime change, as it was in Afghanistan. And when you look at women in Iran, they're, you know, pretty emancipated compared to women in Afghanistan or many Arab countries. You know, women drive very openly. A lot of them are in the workplace. I mean, in several government offices now, you'll see much of the work is done by women, and women are beginning to break through the glass ceiling and get more important kind of management jobs, even in the civil service in Iran. And yes, they pay a cost because they look after their families, they go home and they cook, and their husbands probably don't necessarily help that much with the housework and so on, and looking after children. But, you know, they are progressing and things are really changing. And when those women who are at the sort of lower levels of government offices get to a more senior management level, things will really change.
And how are the Ayatollahs regard this growth of the Iranian career woman?
Difficult to say. I mean, obviously, many of them believe in an interpretation of Islam that doesn't approve of women, you know, being out of the house, particularly in the evenings or late at night. They feel that women should have the primary responsibility for bringing up children. Many of them do. Not all of them, of course. There are very liberal clerics as well, to be fair. I mean, that's something that you sort of don't realize if you live abroad. There are clerics who've been to jail in Iran because they're reformists or they want reform or they're moderate. And they're very outspoken and very brave, too. Not all of them are, you know, against women's rights or human rights or these sort of things. But yeah, there are some that find that difficult. But I think this, what you're seeing is the fact that women took part in the revolution, that they've therefore come into their own a bit after that, and the fact that the Islamic system allows for women to have the vote, that's really important. So they still have to woo women to a certain extent because they're half the electorate.
And what explains the predominance of women in higher education now? Why are more of them getting college degrees than men?
I think a large part of it is the creation of this university called Azad University, Free University, which has branches in many provincial towns. And a lot of families who didn't want to send their daughters to Tehran or big cities because they felt there might be a sort of corrupting influence and they couldn't keep an eye on them were happier to keep their daughters at home or close by and let them go to this university. Then, of course, the fact that the university system since the revolution has been, you know, highly segregated and, you know, that you know your daughter's going to be safe and she's not going to be running around with boyfriends, that's the kind of attitude. So people have been more ready to send their daughters to universities. That's helped a bit too. And then, of course, you know, there's a huge economic pressure on young men to earn money, and they don't seem to see a university degree as a route to a better career. They seem to think that they have to start work immediately, and many families are under a lot of economic pressure. So they leave school and they start work in various businesses or trade or whatever. And the girls, who are not expected to produce money for the family necessarily, they go to university. And so there's this huge imbalance where roughly 65, sometimes 75% of the students in universities are women. And, you know, then you have this issue of who do they marry? Do they marry a guy who doesn't have a university degree? And what kind of problems does that cause later on in their marriage?
Well, you know, in February, there were a lot of stories in the United States about plans for military action against Iran, you know, motivated both by anger over Iran's nuclear program and the accusation that Iran is fueling the insurgency in Iraq and supplying deadly weapons to kill U.S. troops. Do Iranians think that there may be an American invasion? That it's a real possibility?
Well, it depends on which particular period. I think Iranians have become more worried since the UN sanctions came into place that, you know, the international community is going to take action against Iran over its nuclear program. And they are worried about the impact of that on the economy. Before that, before the UN sanctions came into place in late December, really, when you talk to people about the prospect of military strike or sanctions, they were terribly blasé, and partly because they were sort of brainwashed by Iranian television, which told them that, look, we've been under American sanctions for decades and it hasn't hurt us. actually it has, but I mean, they argue that it hasn't really damaged Iran. It's certainly damaged its industry. And they say, well, you know, we've been through a very devastating 8-year-long war with Iraq in the 80s, and we survived that. And, you know, all the superpowers, all the powers abroad backed Iraq, and we were isolated, and yet we survived. So they've told people that, you know, Iran is so powerful, it's such a great nation, it has such a wonderful military that it can survive an American attack if it were to happen. And then they say Iran is so powerful, nobody will dare to attack us, and that sort of thing. And a lot of people have swallowed that. And then, you know, you also have to remember that Iranians live under this threat of attack and isolation and, you know, being ostracized. They've lived like that for decades. You know, there's always one crisis after another. And so if you're a person living in Iran, you just have to go about your normal life. You have to plan for sending your kid to university. You have to save money. You have to move house. You know, you can't be worrying about a military attack all the time. But certainly people, you know, do periodically ask. They particularly ask us as foreign journalists, you know, what do you think? Do you think it will happen? Some people start sort of, you know, thinking about whether to send their children abroad and that kind of thing. And some shopkeepers start hoarding goods and worrying about the exchange rate and so on. But on the whole, people live their lives, you know, with this thing in the back of their minds.
You know, a lot of Iranian leaders have argued that on this issue of Iran being a major player in the insurgency in Iraq, that Iranians don't really regard a disintegrated Iraq as being in their interest, that they really want a stable Shia-dominated government. What is your view of the U.S. assertion that Iran is really fueling the insurgency in Iraq?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult sitting in Iran to know quite what the Iranian involvement in Iraq is. I mean, I think in a way a correspondent in Baghdad might have a much clearer idea of quite how entrenched the Iranians are. I mean, certainly they have an interest with the Shiite groups, the armed groups, many of whom have been based in Iran during the Saddam Hussein years and have very, very close links to the Revolutionary Guards in Iran. There are close ties there politically, militarily. And certainly the Iranian government and establishment feels it can't betray the Shiite population inside Iraq. It has to help them if they're under threat from Sunnis. So there is that aspect there. You know, whatever goes on in terms of any kind of alleged military assistance and so on is very hidden. It's secret. It's not something that you know if you live in Iran. It's very difficult to say what actually happens. But there is, you know, a lot of interest, keen interest in what goes on there. But the other argument that overall it doesn't serve Iran's interest to see the disintegration of Iraq is a very strong one. And a lot of people say that. And that is the argument that the Iraqi foreign minister has been using whenever he's come to Iran to try and persuade the Iranians to take part in direct talks with the United States over Iraq. He said, you know, look what will happen. Iraq will break into a separate Kurdish entity, and that will be a problem for your Iranian Kurdish areas. They will then want to be separate more than they do already. It will break into a Sunni kind of entity, and that will be implacably opposed to Iran, and it will be worse than Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And then you'll have a small Shiite sort of state, and okay, that will be pro-Iranian, but you'll have to protect those Shiite people, and how are you going to do that? So I think that argument has been made very forcefully by the Iraqis to, you know, even the supreme leader and President Ahmadinejad, that they have to prevent all-out civil war in Iraq, that Iran must play a positive role in order to protect the Shiites inside Iraq.
Many Americans' views of Iran were formed by the 1979 revolution and the subsequent hostage crisis and the image of the Ayatollah Khomeini. What do Americans not understand about Iran?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you something funny about the hostage crisis now. Every year, the Iranians have this sort of demonstration, protest, kind of gathering, rally, whatever you call it, outside the former American embassy, which they call the Den of Spies. And they bus in school children to shout slogans like Death to America and so on, and people to make speeches. And one time I asked the school kids, who were quite rowdy and behaving rather badly, but mostly happy to get a day off school, I asked them, OK, what is this building behind you? Do you know what this building is that you're demonstrating outside? And they said, oh, Den of Spies. And I'm like, yeah, but do you know what it was before? And then they didn't know. And I said, do you realize this is the former American embassy? And they said, no. And we said, OK, why are you here today? And they said, oh, to honor the martyrs, which is, you know, classic kind of Iranian thing, to honour the martyrs. And we were like, well, which martyrs? You know, none of the hostage takers died. Would it surprise you to know that a lot of them are in jail and are reformists now? And they were shocked, and they thought that they'd all died. And so, you know, the level of knowledge is tragic, really, in Iran amongst school children who were bussed in for the event. They don't even know what really happened during the hostage taking now, this generation. And yet, you know, it's something that has affected Iran's relationship with the outside world and with the United States, you know, for decades. And And it's something that doesn't really kind of impinge very much anymore on Iranians. And when you look at the hostage takers themselves, very few will come out and say, we made a mistake. They will say it was right at the time. But they've all changed their politics. And, you know, the majority of them are now reformists who want gradual change, who want a different kind of Islamic system in Iran. And that in itself is pretty significant, that Iran's the people who did this have moved on.
You know, you've spent these 3 years you know, kind of straddling British and Iranian culture. You're married to an Iranian man, and you have a son who has, you know, one a British mom and an Iranian dad. I'm wondering if you've given thought to how he's going to regard these two cultures and how you're going to present them to him.
Well, I think we've had to present both of them to him, you know, already. This issue has come up, although he's only just about seven. You know, I hope that he will remember the good things about Iran, not just his family, of course. We have a lot of, you know, relatives in Iran with whom he's sort of instinctively very close. You know, the blood tie is very strong. But I hope he will remember the things that you can be proud of, like the heritage in Iran, the ancient civilization, you know, Persepolis. My son is called Cyrus. Cyrus is, you know, the founder of the Persian Empire. It's a distinctly un-Islamic but very Persian name, and it's important. And so he's very interested in Cyrus the Great's tomb. He's been there. I think, you know, the culture is still very strong, Persian culture. Although the Islamic regime has tried to wipe a lot of it away and destroy it, it's still there, and it's, you know, you see it, it's very rich. People will eat pizza and burgers and so on, but they will also, you know, eat kebabs on Friday, for sure, and they will know how to cook Persian stews and curries, which are quite distinctive from anything else in the Middle East. There's a sort of thing called taaruf. It's like a sort of politesse, a courtesy thing, where you have to speak in a sort of code to each other, which is quite beautiful to watch if it's done properly. And so the sense of hospitality is huge. There are many things that, you know, as an Iranian, you can be proud of, even if you live abroad or you don't support the Islamic system and so on. But, you know, I hope that by living there, he will have seen what's good about Iran and understand that, as well as, of course, you know, speaking English and living in Britain. But I think that the thing that struck me in the last few months in Iran that is becoming more difficult is because of this increasing sort of phobia about contact with foreigners, and particularly Brits, and this sense that there is no place for Iranians who bridge the two worlds. I mean, we've seen that more and more, like the Iranian-Americans, the diaspora who come back, who get arrested, or you know, the demonstrations outside the British embassy where they said that any Iranians who had contact with the British embassy or went to their social functions were dirty traitors and dirty Iranians. You know, that was pretty personal for me in a way, because my son is half Iranian, half British. And what does that mean? That, you know, if you're an Iranian, you can't have anything to do with British people, then you're a dirty traitor. Does that mean my husband is one? You know, that there is less space in this very conservative environment for the people who want to, you know, bridge the gap between the West and Iran. And inside Iran, those people are not necessarily welcome at the moment. The time is not right for them. So that is quite difficult if you're mixed.
Well, Frances Harrison, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're most welcome.